Here's a very interesting question. What are the theories that Hayek, Mises, and Rothbard got wrong on economics or political philosophy that have been fixed by later economic theorists? Does anyone want to take a shot at that?
Leave Walter.
Yeah, of course.
Well, I think Mises's theory of monopoly wasn't complete, wasn't completely thought through, where he believed that a monopoly could exist on a free market, though it wouldn't be empirically a very important phenomenon. And I think Rothbard, basically using Mises' assumptions, showed that you could not distinguish between a competitive price and a monopoly price on a free market. That is that the hot dog vendor in front of my school could just as easily find that his demand curve is now suddenly more inelastic and raise prices, just as GM could find that a particular model that they have faces an inelastic demand curve, meaning that you could earn a greater sum of money at a higher price than at a lower price. So I think Rothbard falls in the tradition of Mises, but that he improved Mises' monopoly theory.
I've suggested that Hayek got things a little wrong in Prices and Production when he suggested that consumption would be curtailed during the boom. And that's also totally at odds with Mises, who talks about malinvestment and overconsumption. And I think several of us have corrected for that in recent articles, emphasizing the overconsumption during the boom as a prominent feature, and especially in the last episode with the real estate boom.
I think there are a few places in Man, Economy, and State where Rothbard is a little bit inconsistent or not as precise as he could be in some of the early chapters where he deals with price formation. His treatment of equilibrium is a little bit inconsistent. And in his production chapters, he sometimes talks about entrepreneurship or what he calls the decision-making factor as a factor of production, but elsewhere in his own theory, it's more clear that decision-making is something that's sort of outside. The decision-maker is the one who arranges the factors, and sort of ultimate decision authority cannot itself be a factor of production with a marginal product and a supply curve and so forth. I mean, I don't think these are particularly significant technical errors, but they're things that I would have written differently if I were writing it, which I didn't.
Do you want to follow up on this specifically?
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking, I don't know what Hayek is on it, but Mises and Rothbard's positions on intellectual property have been greatly improved thanks to Kinsella standing on the shoulders of Hoppe.
I think a lot of Kinsella's position, if you look at it, actually it goes back to Sam Konkin, who was a radical libertarian who wrote in the 1970s and said many of the same things that was said by Kinsella later on. Someone asks here, or makes a statement, it's possible to introduce a kind of money to improve economic calculation in relationships and marriage. So, physic profit? It's increased?
Psychic.
Oh, psychic. Okay. You got to work on your spelling there. You talk about a physic, I'm thinking of... not a good image, is increased. I don't think that, as Mises points out, that many relationships are outside the market nexus, meaning they're outside of the area where prices are determined, and therefore, such as love in marriage or the choice of someone to date and so on, these types of relationships depend on valuation. That is the direct comparison of, let's say, marrying one person against marrying another person. Or in your daily life, instead of watching another hour of TV, getting up and using that hour to cook something to satisfy your hunger. You don't need economic calculation for that. Okay, valuation is sufficient. So I don't think you get any improvements. I mean, even if you could introduce some money within the marriage relationship. Okay, how do Ayn Rand's ideas fit in Austrian economic thought, or fit with Austrian economic thought?
I think Rand's philosophy is not in itself inconsistent with Austrian thought, but it's not required by it either. I think Rand had particular criticisms of Mises, especially she thought he relied too much on a Kantian theory of knowledge, and she thought he made mistakes, because she has notes that she wrote that were published on her copy of Human Action. Some of them are a bit on the unusual side. She says she has one note that in one place Mises refers to demand and supply instead of supply and demand. She thinks that's suspicious. She doesn't say what she thinks is wrong with it. So I think somebody could certainly support both. Now, there's a book by this fellow, Buechner, who claims to reconstruct economics on objectivist principles, but I read part of it. I didn't think he was getting anywhere, but I mean, there are people who claim that there's one thing the objectivists tend not to like, they don't like talking about subjective value. They'll talk about relative value, but not subjective value. So I think basically, though, I don't see any real inconsistencies, of course. I think there are a lot of problems with objectivism in place, but that's something else.
Edgar?
I have a question regarding that. Is that why Reisman wanted to bring back the theories of the classics, and in his book, Capitalism, like to make a more Rabianish version of the Austrian school?
Well, I don't know that he was specifically motivated by objectivist considerations, and I think he just thought that certain parts of Ricardian economics were correct or had been undervalued, and he thought they could be combined with Austrian view. So he had kind of a combination of both, and neither Mises nor Rothbard accepted that. There's, I think, an unpublished paper by Rothbard on Riesman's economics that's extremely negative, but I don't think Riesman was mainly motivated by objectivist considerations, although possibly was. I don't know. I mean, he certainly doesn't indicate that in the book, though.
Okay, thank you, David. What would Austrian economics consider the use of DCF and other Excel-based financial analysis tools as too mathematical, aggregated, and naive? If so, what role do they play in the formation of bubbles? I really don't have any knowledge on that. Does anyone?
I mean, I don't know that Austrian economists per se have a specific position on this. I mean, these are sort of technical managerial forecasting tools, and just as an entrepreneur might use any number of methods to do a marketing study to try to, anticipate or exercise judgment about future consumer demand. I think these are sort of entrepreneurial techniques about which economic theory per se doesn't really have an opinion. And as a practical matter, did these kind of things contribute to the housing bubble? I mean, Edgar would be the guy to ask on that. He's got, others have theorized that particular accounting practices like mark-to-market accounting has, you know, tended to make entrepreneurial decision-making worse than it otherwise would be and may contribute, particularly problematic during asset bubbles. But again, these are sort of, these are pragmatic issues and not really issues in Austrian economic theory. I don't know if anybody else wants to.
Well, of course, some of the models like the so-called CAPM model, capital asset pricing model, turned out to be disastrous because they were calculated on the basis of Federal Reserve determined interest rates and without knowing what the natural rate would be. And so the predictions from those models turned out to be disastrously wrong.
Okay, given that there is no non-arbitrary definition of life, intelligence, or consciousness, how is teleology not dependent on an arbitrary division between choice and casualties written here, but I think it means causality?
Would you give me that one
yes.
again?
Given that there is no non-arbitrary definition of life, intelligence, or consciousness, how is teleology not dependent on an arbitrary division between choice and causality?
Well, I must say I'm not really understanding that question. It seems to be rather confused. First of all, it's just an assertion that we don't have definitions of these things. I'm not going to come up with it, but I'm supposing it's right that we don't have definitions of consciousness or life. It wouldn't follow that our use of the concepts is arbitrary. Maybe we just know them when we see them or can use them adequately without being able to give a precise definition of them. I mean, suppose we know what tables and chairs are, but it would be very difficult to give an exact definition of tables and chairs. Then, secondly, I don't see, supposing we can't have a separate, exact, or non-arbitrary definition between life and consciousness, that wouldn't show that the distinction between teleology and, I guess, by causation they mean efficient causation, rather teleology is a kind of, I don't think that would show that distinction is arbitrary. I mean, maybe we wouldn't know, if it's right, we wouldn't know whether whatever is exercised doing the teleology or the efficient causation was living or non-living, but why would it follow? We wouldn't be able to distinguish between those two. I think it sounds like this person has a bad condition of making everything arbitrary. I mean, if you say that, the person can certainly say that, but we want to see some argument to that effect. So basically, his premise, the questioner's premises are wrong, and the conclusion that the person draws from the premises doesn't follow from the premises. Otherwise, everything's all right. I remember, I'll just tell you one story. As you know, I'm a very old man. I always tell stories. I once was talking to Bob Nozick about someone who'd come up with a certain argument on rights, and I said, I think every step of this argument is wrong. And then I gave him the argument, and he said to me, you realize every step's wrong, don't you?
Okay, here's a question similar to one we've had already, but we might want to take a crack at it again. What purpose, if any, do you believe econometrics serves in Austrian economics? I think we covered that. Yeah, okay. Can a free market be sustained by an immoral people?
Well, I don't see, I mean, as long as they follow the rules of the free market, I don't see why not. I mean, they could do all sorts of other things that were wrong, but I mean, as long as they're respecting other people's rights, I don't think there'd be any problem. I mean, after all, the market depends on just, it doesn't require people to have particularly good motives in acting. It's just a framework in which people act. Sorry. Well, you're better off not hearing what I said.
I was going to add something to that. Okay, forget what he just said. I don't know if this is what the questioner had in mind, but it's a kind of meta-theoretic issue. I mean, there are different schools of thought on this. There's an important difference between Hayek and Mises on this kind of point, that Hayek maintained that it wasn't necessary for economic actors not so much to be moral, but to sort of appreciate or understand why voluntary market interaction is beneficial. It could be a purely kind of evolutionary explanation where we find that acting in the marketplace brings some benefits until we continue to act in voluntary market interaction, but we don't understand why it works, and that's okay. Mises believed that as a practical matter, it was very important that people do understand why the free market brings social harmony and social benefit. It's very important to educate people, and that there was a sort of moral foundation, or at least a epistemological foundation, that was necessary to sustain a free market.
Just one point. I think Mises certainly had a strong argument there that people need to understand the foundations of the free market in order for the system to operate. But you see, it wouldn't follow from that that they have to regard those foundations as morally right, or that they themselves have to be moral. That would be an additional claim. That would just be saying people have to understand how the system works and act accordingly. I think also there was a similar dispute between Buchanan and Tulloch, that Tulloch thinks as long as you have the institutions working with people can have whatever motives they want. Buchanan's one who stresses people have to have certain virtues or certain patterns of behavior in order for the system to work.
Okay, following up on that, can a society of perfect political and economic liberty be sustained by people who make choices not evaluated by the criterion of liberty? For example, people choosing a state of intoxication through drugs and alcohol, which precludes full control of one's ability to operate in political and economic liberty.
Let me see. Well, I think that question is really confusing two senses of liberty. The first, you have to follow the, in order for the system to operate, that people have to obey not violate other people's rights. You can't have a lot of people who violate people's rights, and it's the case that usually that people who are, say, acting not drunk or acting reasonably are more likely to do that, but it wouldn't follow that they have to be sober all the time. Sometimes drunk people observe people's rights and don't violate them. So I don't think it would follow people always have to act in a perfectly free way in some moral sense of freedom for them to observe rights. But I think incidentally, the person who asked that question has told me that she wanted that question withdrawn. who cares
Done.
What she wants?
Was she intoxicated?
Well, certainly from the question, one would assume that, but...
Okay, in an anarcho-capitalist society, we prefer totally voluntary society here, how could a plaintiff bring the alleged offender to court? Well, I know what Murray Rothbard says in Ethics of Liberty is that you wouldn't have to bring them to court. If they didn't come to court, then they could be tried in absentia. And in that case, they would have less of a chance of winning the case. You okay, man?
Like we were arguing.
Okay.
I'll get away.
Any other comments on that? Yeah, go ahead.
There are a lot of, this is an interesting question, but it's worth pointing out that, you know, sort of the details of how a system like that could actually function in practice at this point are unknown. I mean, it would be up to, you know, law and justice entrepreneurs competing with each other and experimenting and so forth to figure these things out. I mean, there's a, you know, Murray Rothbard had this, tried to answer that kind of question with an analogy that many of you have heard. He's, or at least a thought experiment. He said, you know, imagine that there was a world in which the production of shoes had always been monopolized by the state. Right, there were state-run shoe factories and shoe distribution networks and so on. And, you know, some crazy Austrian economist or whatever comes along and says, well, maybe we ought to privatize the shoe industry and let the free market provide shoes. You know, the shoe statist would reply, well, that's crazy. You know, how could that ever work? Explain to me exactly what the shoe industry would look like in the free market. How many shoes would be produced? What styles of shoes would they be? What color? What sort of, you know, what shoes would poor people have? What shoes would rich people have? And of course, the correct answer would be, who knows? I mean, you'd have to kind of let, you can't predict that ex ante, but we can say based on theory that entrepreneurs would tend to do a much better job of producing the quality and quantity and variety of shoes that the market demands relative to government provision of shoes. So it's the same thing when your friends ask you, well, how would the free market handle X or Y or Z? Sometimes the response can be, well, we don't know exactly, but we can be confident that entrepreneurs would figure this out. And the burden of proof isn't on the advocate of market provision to specify all of the details. The burden of proof is on the opponent to explain why government provision of this thing should be better than market provision of this thing.
Jonathan, yeah.
But we can do what Joe described earlier as pattern prediction.
Right? We can't describe the exact workings, but we can say, well, let's look at other industries that are similar to the provision of law and justice. We can look at episodes in history where various forms of law and justice have been provided by private parties. We can look at contemporary analogies, you know, voluntary dispute resolution among certain kinds of commercial, in certain kinds of commercial conflicts. And sure, we can make informed conjectures about how we think it probably would work, but it isn't incumbent upon us to spell out every detail. And we should point out that we would expect innovation, right? There are probably techniques or technologies for bringing accused rights violators, you know, to court or dealing with them in some way that we haven't figured out yet. If there's an incentive to innovate and figure out a better way to do it, we could expect that entrepreneurs will. We just don't know exactly how they would do it.
You can always also look into the interstices, the gaps in the current society, and look at areas, for example, the rich living in almost never depending on government police, living in gated communities, having their own bodyguards, and so on. So there, you know, there are markets operating in those areas, and they're operating very effectively, it seems to me. So you can make those sort of arguments. Yes, on this point.
But,
is there a but in here? Is there a but in that?
Well, I mean, the way he was describing it earlier was that everyone would have, you know, their own private property and kind of their, they'd be like the lord of that property and have their own sort of laws. I was wondering, well, if I were on your property, would I forfeit a right to free speech or right to, you know, free expression?
I live in a community in which, or a development in which, there is a neighborhood association. It's voluntary. These are called bylaws. They're not laws that everyone has to obey, but people who voluntarily have entered into contracts to buy houses in that area or in that development, are not allowed to paint their houses certain colors. They can't have their cars left on the street overnight. They have to get any sort of a fence approved, and things like that. I mean, that's, you know, many communities are like that. And this is a, you know, middle class community. So the key, as Murray Rothbard always pointed out, was who owns the roads, and because the road owners would then set conditions for using their roads. Also, may themselves buy adjacent property to develop, developments along the sides of the roads, and that would solve the problem of pollution right there because it would be written to the contract. I mean, there are many different things that are going on right now that you could bring the bear. But the property owner doesn't say, you come on my property, I can kill you or anything like that. He sets the bylaws, let's say, or the rules for his own property, each property owner. So, you know, every productive piece of property, every scarce piece of property has rules that you have to abide by. So for example, I was at Pork Fest, the Libertarian Festival in New Hampshire about a month ago, and people were walking around. This was at a private campground. I was surprised. I mean, people were walking around with automatic weapons on you know, slung over their shoulders. And the property owner allowed that. But many of the libertarians that were there thought that, well, this would be the way it was, you know, everywhere. Of course it wouldn't be. Schools may or may not allow an armed guard or teachers to be armed. Neighborhoods may not want to see any, may have their own rules about who can carry guns and whether they can be concealed or open. It's not a free-for-all. Again, the property owners, especially if they're people that are responding to a demand on the market, will implement rules that consumers demand. So it'd be a mosaic in the good sense, not in the sense that, oh, New York City's a mosaic. Okay.
I just follow up on one thing Joe said. One thing Rothbard was very clear is that in a libertarian society, it isn't a collection of absolute monarchies in which each person is sovereign over his own property. That was an objection. Sidney Morganbesser was a very good philosopher at Columbia University, famous for very witty remarks, once said, oh, you don't reject government, you think everybody's a government, but that isn't what the situation was at all.
Here's a question that, again, I was hoping to avoid. Fractional reserve banking based on mutual consent on a contractual basis is this. Possible on a free market, compatible with the non-aggression axiom. Anyone want to address that? Okay. We'll go on to the next question. It depends on how you define a free market. As an economist, as an Austrian economist, I would say, I would make an empirical conjecture that fractional reserve banking would tend to collapse on a free market. Because it's inherently unstable. Even if you don't want to say it's inherently bankrupt, it's inherently unstable because it depends so much on confidence. I made this point in my banking lecture earlier in the week, so that's one point. And there's a second point that I wanted to make also there would be other means that would satisfy the same ends. Which is to say that you would have, if you want highly liquid funds that you can easily cash in, you could have money market mutual funds in which there is no demand for or no right to claim a deposit, but there's you're an equity shareholder in the money market mutual fund. So there can be no bank runs in that case because if the portfolio doesn't do well and loses money, the money market mutual fund, it's in the contract, can lower everybody's share. The share is usually set at a dollar by 10%, let's say, or something like that. So from the economic point of view, I think it would be outcompeted and it would also collapse because it's unstable. Roger may have a different view on that. But I certainly would prefer that without any central bank, any federal deposit insurance, to having this current system with a central bank.
But you haven't said it's fraudulent.
No, I haven't said it's fraudulent. That's an ethical judgment, and I don't think that should adulterate the debate, the economic debate. on free banking, which unfortunately it does, and it gets it off track. It's a misfocus of the debate. Yes.
Yeah, it's quite a similar question. I know you didn't say that it was social. No. I was wondering, how many of these institutions do any of them use fractional reserve banking in that bustle of lives? And if so, do you think you're being defrauded?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if anybody up here has ever said it's fraudulent. I've never written that it was fraudulent.
So
maybe Walter Block, I know, has written that it's fraudulent. Well, ask Walter. He'll talk to you for a long time about that. Speaking of Walter, voluntary slavery, a contradiction? Anyone?
I don't think it's a contradiction, one shouldn't have it, but I don't see that it's a contradictory idea. But I mean, there are all sorts of reasons to oppose something besides there being a contradiction after all. But I mean, I suppose somebody just signed himself away into slavery. I don't see what would be the contradiction, but that's inconsistent. It doesn't, in the way I would understand the self-ownership principle, the person wouldn't be allowed to do that, or contracts of that kind wouldn't be binding. But again, it's not a logical contradiction as far as I can see. There are people who have a more expansive view of what you can get from logical principles than I do. I remember Bob Nozick once said, the Randian argument for free will is A is A, therefore we've got free will. Some people draw all sorts of consequences.
If I could answer a related question that wasn't asked, but I'll answer it anyway. There are some libertarian theorists who think that that any kind of sort of voluntary, consensual hierarchy or submission is incompatible in some sense with a purely free society. And I don't hold that view at all, that any kind of employment contract involves some discretion on the part of the supervisor or the manager. There's some range of activities within which the employer can tell the employee what to do without it being specified in detail ex ante. And there's some libertarian social theorists and philosophers who regard that as sort of, bossing people around. And that I've even heard some use the term bossism, implying that bossism is incompatible with liberty or incompatible with the free market or private property. And I certainly don't think that's correct at all. You can voluntarily submit yourself to someone else's guidance. You can voluntarily agree to follow someone else's dictates. That isn't slavery, of course, because you can choose whether to enter the relationship and you can choose whether to get out of it. There may be some damage payment if the contract specifies that you have to pay damages if you opt out of the contract. But I don't think there's anything about voluntary submission to authority that's incompatible with the free market or the free society.
Okay, we're running pretty thin on questions. Anyone want to ask questions from the audience? Sure.
Why has socialism as an intellectual movement so pervaded our academic institutions? Because all the smart people.
I mean, Hayek has a very good article on that called The Intellectuals and Socialism, 1948, I think. I wrote a Mises Daily that is basically just summarizing some of Hayek's arguments and also some arguments from Joseph Schumpeter that I think are very good. I mean, part of it is sort of selection bias. This is an argument that was emphasized by Hayek that, you have a lot of really smart people in the world. Hayek thought that, very intelligent people who are attracted to market activity. They like engaging in commerce. They have some kind of entrepreneurial ability. They tend to go into business and into the professions. They become entrepreneurs and so forth. You know, equally intelligent people who are uncomfortable with market exchange or suspicious of the market. They don't like business and commerce. They tend to go into academia, journalism. They become part of the intelligentsia. But of course, the former group, you rarely hear them, or, you know, they're behind the scenes. They're not on the news. They're not lecturing in front of large groups. They're just being entrepreneurs. The latter group, their job is to write and teach and talk and be on television and be in front of the classroom. So people mistakenly think, gosh, you know, all the really smart people are socialists or lean towards socialism, therefore maybe that must be true. But no, you're only seeing a biased sample of the smart people. It's the smart people who chose to go into academia. So there's a selection bias at work there. Schumpeter also thought there's, you know, what you might call a treatment effect as well as a selection effect, that academics are largely isolated from the market. Their compensation is not related to their performance in a very serious way. They can be critics of the market without it really costing them anything. They don't really understand the market very well. They're threatened by the market. They denounce it. You could also say that because we have a very wealthy society relative to other societies in history, it's like, you know, the cost of having foolish and incorrect economic views is pretty low, right? I mean, the market does such a good job of providing even for left-wing intellectuals that they can have all these crazy views and get away with it. You know, if they were out in the, you know, on the frontier having to make their own way, they, you know, the socialists would quickly be weeded out.
Yes, over here. Really?
Well, you see, it's certainly true. Hans Hoppe's arguments have a deductive form that are relying on the notion of action as used in praxeology, but I don't think that suffices to make them praxeology or part of praxeology. They're not part of the study of action. There are certain conclusions that he draws about how nature of self-ownership and how the correct principle of initial acquisition. So I don't see how those are part of praxeology. I mean, I just don't see. Of course, if you said they were, I mean, that would just be a terminological problem. Then you could say, okay, well, let's distinguish, put the part of praxeology that doesn't include that. That's the value-free part. Nothing much would turn on this distinction, you see.
Yes.
I would like to ask about the role of themology and sociobiology in libertarian theory.
What was before sociobiology? Themology and sociobiology in libertarian theory.
Oh, well, I think, of course, Mises uses themology, or what he calls specific understanding, in when he's understanding history. But I don't think that's particularly a part of libertarian theory. That's just a way of understanding individual action, historical events. I mean, sociobiology is that's a different question. Rothbard was very suspicious of sociobiology. I think there are people at this conference who are favorable to it. I'm having a mental block on who that might be, but that's another matter. I mean, I think it would just be part of one. If you accepted that, that would just be one of the scientific theories around, but it wouldn't have any direct relevance to libertarian theory, I don't think.
This is probably also for David Gordon. Have you read Michael Humer's Problem of Political Authority, and what are your thoughts?
Michael Humer, yes, I read that. He sent it to me. It's a very good book. He relies on a kind of intuitionist approach to moral theory. I think there's a lot to that. I mean, I think there are a few parts I disagree with. I think it's a very good book. He's very much on the right track, but I'm hoping to do a review of that. But it is a very good book. I mean, it's one of the best books recently on libertarian theory, I think.
Oh, okay, sorry. I was just wondering, I think this question is for... All right, I think this question is mostly for Roger Garrison, probably. In the lectures, I could tell Keynes's capital theory was, to say the least, very lacking, but did he think so much that capital just didn't really matter, the capital structure, or did he think it was actually homogeneous?
No, he just thought that the ideas he was dealing with was movements in the big magnitudes over a short period of time in which he could neglect any changes in capital. His short run, see, all of his policy prescription, goose up the economy, pump money into the economy, and so on, were all just short run fixes to keep the economy afloat long enough to enact some meaningful social reforms, which was his comprehensive socialization of investment, which he announced in chapter 24. He imagined, actually he called them semi-public bodies. He had sort of a pluralistic command economy. He had a number of semi-public bodies, and he mentioned what the railroads in London and the ports, London ports, that weren't exactly private, they weren't exactly government, but they would make decisions on the basis of the amount of employment those decisions would cause rather than on profit motives and so on. He had this in mind, but all of his policies were very short run and were to take effect in a time that didn't allow for much in the way of capital changes.
Okay, we're out of our allotted time. Thank you very much.